The Guardian.
Welcome to the Guardian Books podcast, where the writer and former barrister Joseph O'Neill talks to Guy de Man about his new novel Netherland, which has been garnering rave reviews on both sides of the Atlantic.
Hello, my name is Guy de Man, and we're here at the Hay Festival talking to the novelist Joseph O'Neill, whose third novel, Netherland, has just been published. And to say it's been greeted by rave reviews would be an understatement indeed. James Wood, the influential literary critic of The New Yorker, hailed it as one of the most remarkable post-colonial books he has ever read, comparing its author to Bellow and Naipaul, and suggesting its narrative of New York identity starts where The Great Gatsby left off. Joseph, before we discuss your book, you're going to very kindly read a short passage from the first chapter, and if you could very kindly introduce the book a little bit beforehand, we'd be very grateful.
Right, well, the narrator of this book is a Dutchman, a Dutch banker who lives in New York and who has moved there with his wife and has a young son there with his wife. And shortly after 9/11, his wife leaves him and goes back to England. She's an English woman. And he's left all alone in New York. And one of the things he does to mitigate his loneliness is to play cricket in New York. And the passage which I'm going to be reading will be about a place called Walker Park, which is an actual cricket ground in Staten Island, where I have and indeed continue to play cricket. But just returning to the actual book itself for a moment, it starts off with Hans back in England after his New York stint, discovering that an old friend of his from New York, Chuck Ramkasoon, who's a Trinidadian, has been found drowned and murdered in the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn. And this triggers a long reminiscence on Hans's part of those years he spent in New York. Anyhow, here we go. I'm reading two bits, which will sound continuous, but are in fact broken up by text I'm not actually going to be reading. This comes early on in the book. By the standards I brought to it, Walker Park was a very poor place for cricket. The playing area was, and I am sure still is, half the size of a regulation cricket field. The outfield is uneven and always overgrown, even when cut. Once chasing a ball, I nearly tripped over a hidden, and to cricketers, ominous duck. And whereas proper cricket, as some might call it, is played on a grass wicket, the pitch at Walker Park is made of clay, not turf, and must be covered with coconut matting. Moreover, the clay is pale, sandy baseball clay, not red cricket clay, and its bounce cannot be counted on to stay true for long. And to the extent that the bounce is true, it lacks variety and complexity. I then go on to describe various cricket grounds in New York City, and I say, what all these recreational areas have in common is a rank outfield that largely undermines the art of batting, which is directed at hitting the ball along the ground with that elegant variety of strokes. A skillful batsman will have spent years trying to master and preserve the glance, the hook, the cut, the sweep, the cover drive, the pull, and all those other offspring of technique, conceived to send the cricket ball rolling and rolling, as if by magic, to the far-off edge of the playing field. Play such shots in New York, and the ball will more than likely halt in the tangled, weedy ground cover. Grass, as I understand it, a fragrant plant wondrously suited for athletic pastimes, flourishes with difficulty. And if something green and grass-like does grow, it is never cut down as cricket requires. Consequently, in breach of the first rule of batting, the batsman is forced to smash the ball into the air to go deep, as we'd say, borrowing the baseball term, and batting is turned into a gamble. As a result, fielding is distorted too, since the fielders are quickly removed from their infield positions, point, extra cover, mid-wicket, and the others to distant stations on the boundary where they listlessly linger. Now, can I just say one thing? This is, I think, the passage I have read is possibly the most cricket-intensive section of the book. Just in case you're wondering, the book doesn't consist entirely of this kind of stuff.
So Joseph, as you say, this book isn't entirely about cricket, but it did strike many of your readers, and myself included, as somewhat remarkable that you choose cricket as a slightly unlikely metaphor for dealing with many of the complex modern themes you deal with in the novel. So why cricket?
Well, first of all, you know, when you write a novel, you don't start off with a set of thematic preoccupations, because a novel is very hard to cook up a novel from that. You have to start off with an actual set of characters or an actual situation, whose metaphorical promise is there and you recognise as such. But your primary impulse is to describe it and to do something dramatic with it. As regards the, you know, the symbolic or the metaphoric content of playing cricket in New York, I mean, it's undoubtedly there. I mean, the first thing that occurred to me, obviously, was that cricket is the other, as far as America is concerned. It's exactly that which America cannot understand. And so if you set a novel in a world which is beyond the visibility of America, you're actually exploring the boundaries of American identity and American vision. And but that aside, you know, I never wanted to sort of fully kind of map out in my mind all the various, you know, theoretical consequences of writing about cricket in New York. You know it's resonating. You know there's a lot of stuff there, and to the extent that it's been called, you know, neocolonial, or a novel about neocolonialism, you always sense that's all in there, but you try not to become too conscious of that when you're writing it.
So there are ways, in fact, the book sets cricket as both innately civilizing or civilizing in itself, and particularly so in the context of America. But the setting of the book is one of a crisis of civilization. It's not the first book to deal about the subject of 9/11 and post 9/11 identity. We've had Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Don DeLillo's Falling Man, and Ian McEwan's Saturday. Everyone admits to the idea that 9/11 changed the world, but how do you think it's changed writing?
Well, I mean, I think if you're in my case, I mean, I conceived of the idea of writing about this countercultural, you know, perversely colonial activity in New York before 9/11 happened. And then 9/11 happened, and it just became obligatory to write about it. I mean, you have no option if you're writing about New York City. I mean, it may well be that some writers sit down and say, I'm going to write a book about 9/11 and I'm going to do justice to the kind of boundless complexity of absolutely everything surrounding 9/11, and good luck to them. But I didn't really think that. I think that if you try to write a novel about, say, New York or America, and in fact lots of, you know, maybe even England or Ireland, you know, nowadays, anything, if you set it before 9/11, you're writing a historic novel of some kind. It's almost a period piece because so much has changed. A lot of the changes, I think, you know, are the result of political manipulations of various kinds. But the fact is, things have changed, and the culture has changed. And we certainly have to try to account for, if you're trying to write about life as it is now, try to account for your experience now, you have to try to account for this strange, in what is a strange gloom which has fallen on, you know, much of the Western world, and this strange kind of fear and disorientation, and my book is obviously located in that world, and, you know, necessarily will deal with it by default, almost.
So, just to step back from the book and talk about you, perhaps. You're Irish-born, but with Turkish ancestry. You were brought up in the Netherlands and educated in the UK. Post-colonial literature is defined partly by the attempt to forge new cultural identities through writing. And could you say in what ways the process of writing this particular book has changed you?
That's a difficult one. I'm not sure it has really changed me in terms of how I identify myself, if that is the question. I mean... I mean, I have this kind of very sort of mixed up background, which you've referred to. I mean, my father's Irish, my mother's Turkish. I actually went to school in Holland, to an international school, and then I went to university in England, and then worked in England as a lawyer for many years. But you know, when I'm writing this book, I'm just thinking of a kind of literary and imaginative exercise, and I don't think. Although actually, now that I am thinking about it for the first time, actually this, you've made me think about it for the first time, I do suppose that it has Americanized me. I mean, the process of writing about New York makes you a New Yorker. I feel that I am a New Yorker, which I think is a slightly different specimen to being an American. I don't really identify with much of the rest of that country, but I do certainly identify with the very mixed bag that is the New York population.
Well, I think James Wood certainly would agree with you in the sense that he wrote, I think, in his review that this is perhaps the book that New Yorkers have been waiting for in order to think and talk about themselves. The other way in which he described you is this kind of perhaps returning hero of post-colonial literary tradition. Do you think post-colonial literature is a useful term?
Yes, I mean, I agree with every word James Wood said in that review. post-colonialism. I think we have to continue to think about the world in post-colonial terms because so much of what we see going on now is, I think, capable of being analysed and understood in those terms. You're talking about population groups in Pakistan, you're talking about the population groups in Afghanistan, you're talking also about Iraq. All these places are obviously are countries that have not fully decolonized, by which I mean they have obviously decolonized to a degree, but what they haven't done is completed the process by which they form an entirely successful culture and a political system of their own. I mean, these places are still in turmoil. So in broad terms, post-colonialism obviously continues to be a relevant, way of looking at the world. I mean, in terms of New York and the United States, I don't think it's necessarily post-colonialism in the traditional sense, but I do think that it is about power, and it is about, I mean, the American, I mean, America at the moment is a very substantial empire, and to play cricket there, and to insist on this foreign activity, and to insist on colonizing, as it were, parts of New York City as Chuck does, for a purpose which, you know, is not an American purpose, is a kind of response to the American assertion of power which we've been seeing for 100 years, and it's a check on it. It's an attempt to modify it and to bring it into line with other extra American narratives and perspectives. So in that sense, the post-colonial kind of analysis has a bearing, and I'm sure. But I can't quite account for everything, of course, James Wood is thinking about. But that's certainly a thing. That's something I can come up with.
Joseph O'Neill, thank you very much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.